Good afternoon, everyone. I am calling the meeting of the House Committee on Rules together for Tuesday, May 9th. For your information, House Bill 3361, we are not going to do anything with that today, but we will revisit it next Tuesday.
Thank you.
So if you're here for that, you don't have to be here anymore. All right, with that, I am going to open a work session on House Bill 3241.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, 3241 allows local government to create residential property assessed clean energy program, otherwise known as PACE, to assist owners of single family dwellings in financing utility improvements and seismic rehabilitation. You do have a dash A3 amendment, which I believe the sponsor of the measure is here to discuss with you today.
Great. Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Chair Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pam Marsh. I'm the representative from House District 5, which includes Ashland, Talon, Phoenix, and Jacksonville, other end of the state. I'm here today to urge your support for House Bill 3241 with the dash 3 amendments. This bill will expand Oregon's current PACE program, which stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy, to include single-family residential dwellings. PACE is a model financing mechanism that provides low-cost, long-term funding for energy and water efficiency projects. PACE financing can be repaid directly to the lender or as an assessment on the qualifying real property's regular tax bill and processed the same way as other local public benefit assessments like sidewalks and sewers. The PACE financing mechanism was pioneered by the state of California about 10 years ago and is currently active in the states of California, Florida, and Missouri specifically. In 2009 and 2014, the Oregon legislature approved legislation to authorize local governments to establish commercial PACE programs. Multnomah County pioneered the first commercial PACE program in the state in September 2005 by creating Property Fit, a collaboration between the county, the Portland Development Commission, and the Energy Trust of Oregon. Currently, PACE programs in Oregon are limited to commercial, industrial, and multifamily residential properties. HB 3241-3 will expand PACE authorization to include residential single-family dwellings of up to 4 units. Here's how the program will work. Participating local governments will secure funding via revenue bonds or private sources. Loans will be issued to qualifying homeowners for residential utility improvements, including energy or water efficiencies, renewable energy, energy storage, and smart electric vehicle charging stations. Funding may also be used for seismic rehabilitation projects, and this is something we added here in Oregon because we think it could be of great benefit, especially in our coastal communities. Eligible homeowners will undergo an energy or water audit to ensure that the cost of improvements do not exceed the cumulative cost savings over the life of the investment, which is an important consumer protection. Projects may be funded at up to 100% of costs, but may not exceed 20% of the real market value of the property. The total of improvement and any existing mortgage cannot exceed 97% of real market value. Local governments can choose to secure the loan with a lien in the same manner as used with other local improvements, for example, sewers or street projects. Local governments will be free to impose other requirements as appropriate. I want to call out in particular the strong consumer protection language that we have added with the recent amendment. It both requires adherence to the best practices guidelines for residential PACE financing programs that was published by the U.S. Department of Energy in November 2016. And we also have added in detailed requirements that mirror disclosure and consumer protection standards passed in California last year. And that were supported by local real estate banking and credit union entities in California. These standards address property disclosures, contractor conduct, acceptable products and projects with pricing guidelines, marketing practices, pre- and post-funding support, treatment of protected classes, grievance procedures, data security, and privacy matters. We have also mandated financial disclosures, including fees, payments, fixed interest rate, annual tax obligation, repayment process, and the schedule. These protections should shield both homeowners and lenders from possible abuses of the program. Finally, I would like to directly address some specific concerns that I suspect you will hear in a few minutes from the banking industry. First, there has been some concern expressed that PACE loans are secured by a lien that is primary to the existing mortgage and could cause a risk to the mortgage holder and or place the homeowner in default. To review, House Bill 3241A creates a program. This is government tax-based financing, similar to the land-secured districts like water or sewer districts, where the assessment to finance the property improvements run with the property, not the individual. As a government tax-based financing program, repayment is through a government assessment and secured by a government lien on the property. The risk posed by PACE assessments to mortgage lenders and holders is immaterial for several reasons. PACE liens would not accelerate a delinquency or default, which means the only exposure to mortgages is the arrearage of the yearly benefit assessment amount, just what's due now. In February 2017, the asset rating firm Morningstar published an analysis that concluded, "We believe that a PACE assessment does not materially increase the risk to underlying mortgage." Renovate America, the nation's largest PACE provider, has never had a property tax foreclosure or a loss to a mortgage lender across 93,000 projects. Finally, significant evidence demonstrates that PACE projects increase the value of homes, a benefit to both homeowner and to the mortgage insurer. A 2016 peer-reviewed study by the Urban Institute, published in the Journal of Structured Finance, found that PACE increased resale values typically by 100% of the PACE investment, compared to 60% for many other home improvements. A second concern you will hear is that these liens are not permitted for properties financed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who together own about 45% of all home loans. There has also been questions over the attitude of the Federal Housing Administrator toward these loans. In fact, the FHA, which has 40% of home loans, allows PACE assessments so long as the balance does not accelerate or come ahead of the first mortgage in case of default. HB 3241, as amended, contains exactly those provisions. Fannie and Freddie do prohibit a new mortgage from being originated with a PACE lien in first position. So as a result, any PACE assessment may be required to be paid off at the time of refi or sale of the property. HB 3241, as amended, specifically requires this disclosure to the property owner so that there will be no surprises. The property owner will know that if there is an issue with a Fannie or Freddie refi or sale, that he or she may be required, as with any other home loan, to pay off the balance. And the third concern has been expressed is that these loans do not have the consumer protections that are applicable to regular mortgage loans and are not required to disclose fees and costs as required by the Truth in Lending Act. As noted earlier, HB 3241 amended contained strong disclosures, and we added a lot of language about this in the recent amendment process. Consumers will be told that a lien is on the home and that failure to pay can result in foreclosure. Fees are required, as well as the payment schedules. However, the Truth in Lending Act that has been cited by our banking friends is specific to mortgage companies. Strict application to PACE would require local governments to act like mortgage originators, which is not a standard that we can attain. Finally, let me just conclude noting that PACE is another competitive form of financing. It's another tool to try to spread these energy and seismic projects. A homeowner is certainly free to choose another mechanism. But PACE does have the advantage of being transferable. And as in a government assessment funded by bonds, it may offer certain advantages. Nationwide, there are more than 100,000 homes that have PACE-funded energy improvements. With the right tools, our local governments can be extraordinarily effective in furthering critical energy, water, and seismic improvements in our residential neighborhoods. And I hope you will favorably consider this legislation in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how long are these loans, what is the term on them?
The term is, as specified in the legislation, is the lesser of 25 years or the extent of the energy project.
Thank you.
All up to you, Sam.
Chair Williamson, members of the committee. I'm going to keep it short. My name is Sam Barrasso, and I'm from Multnomah County's Office of Sustainability. So I work in developing the the Oregon's first commercial property sized clean energy program. And so I think Representative Marsh did an amazing job in terms of really hitting all the points. I want to be here just to offer myself up to answer any questions. But what I want to mainly say is that this program is not only designed to reduce our carbon emissions, but also spur economic development as well as reduce building business costs. Our current program in targeting commercial does a great job, but it needs to go further, and partly in expanding to single-family residential homes. It's exactly where we need to go in terms of really expanding the reach of this sort of market-based mechanism to do these good things. Just to give you sort of a sense of scale in terms of the benefit this program may have, currently there is over 15 states with commercial programs that have been enabled, and they've done around $340 million in terms of commercial deals. In terms of the scale and potential behind residential deals, it's been enabled in a handful of states, and they've already done over $3.7 billion in deals. So there's a lot of potential behind enabling this sort of mechanism in the residential sphere in terms of both bringing about sort of this holistic homes, you know, residential home resiliency from a seismic perspective, water efficiency, energy efficiency, and renewable energy. So with that, we've worked quite a bit and explored all these range of amendments and been in constant contact with all our colleagues from other states in terms of how to make this program what it is. And we urge your support for HB 3241A with the -3 amendments. So, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for being here. I have two questions. One I think might be better for Sam, and the other one for Representative Marsh. I kind of think about this as a similar idea to the energy trust programs, where you can kind of invest in energy retrofitting your house, and it gives an affordable way for you to do that with a long-term payoff. Is that an appropriate way to think about this?
Yes, I mean, what it does is it makes it, Energy Trust has a great load of resources in terms of bringing incentives to do that, but this brings you financing to really cover the gap between those resources that Energy Trust does. So it's really, when you don't have the money to bring for those out-of-pocket expenses, this allows you to do so, and allows you to do so long-term, so that it makes these measures, which do save energy and do save costs over the long term, more feasible, more economically feasible, and in fact beneficial at that scale.
Great. Follow-up. And actually, I meant to say this as part of the first. I also think it's pretty exciting, the seismic opportunities, because it's not in the name, so I didn't realize until I learned more from Representative Marsh about it. But I think that's a particularly significant impact in Oregon, where we have a lot of conversations in this building and around the state about what can we do to help do that seismic retrofitting, those upgrades. And I think this is a great opportunity. And then Rep. Marsh, so I guess that was a comment rather than a question. And then Rep. Marsh, it sounds from your description like, you know, this bill came here because there was active negotiation going on with the banking industry in particular, that it sounds from your description like you addressed many of their concerns.
Well, we believe, Chair Williamson, Rep. Smith-Warner, we did our best to really provide detail in the bill. We thought, in the prior version of the bill, the kind of consumer protections and so forth were certainly available to local governments, but what we did was to try to spell out especially language around the consumer protections. We added additional information about what a local government should look for in calculating a homeowner's ability to actually pay off a loan. We did some specifications around the requirement that a consumer understand, making sure that a consumer understands that he or she may have to pay off the loan. So we've added everything that we possibly know of to add. I don't think you will find that we've earned the enthusiasm of our banking friends, but we believe that we've addressed them and really produced a bill that has a minimal risk to either the homeowner or to the mortgage holder.
And it is successfully used in multiple other states.
It's been in effect in California for 10 years. They've never seen a foreclosure. In fact, people who have owned PACE loans down there have issues with property tax avoidance at half the rate of other people. So it's got an excellent track record in terms of people who seek out these loans.
Thank you.
Senator Pack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, quick question.
Sure.
Would a lien like this potentially put someone in default?
I do not believe so. There is no evidence of that in California or any place else where we've seen these programs, 100,000 programs. The lien is designed to be subordinated in cases of foreclosure. So the only obligation that would ever fall to the mortgage holder is the amount that's due at the moment of foreclosure. With that, the FHA and the VA have both approved homeowners' mortgages with liens on them in this fashion, because of the fact that the risk is really minimized by the subordination. In California, there hasn't been a case of a default.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In California, you say this is prevalent down in California. When, if they borrow 20% of the value of the home and improve the dwelling, mm-hmm. is that automatically adjusted on their property taxes or their property valuation? I mean, could they invest 20% to the house? Say it's a $200,000 house. They all of a sudden it's $240,000 that they have into it. Can they get that right back on the market with this investment?
I'm sorry. Can you restate the question?
So say it's a $100,000 house, you know, and you put another $20,000 into this house through these improvements. Are those improvements recognized, in real estate to where they automatically would increase the value of that home by 20%?
On their property tax assessment? I believe we have some protections in the state for solar projects that don't increase the property tax assessment when you have an installation. Is that correct?
Okay. Follow up. Yeah, the real market value then of the home, is the real market value, does it increase 20%?
The data shows that the real market, well, first of all, we have a provision in the bill that says that both the cost of the mortgage and the cost of the improvement can exceed 97% of the real market value at time of installation. Yeah. There's also evidence from sales factors in California that there is a significant benefit to the bottom line in terms of overall home value on the long term.
Okay.
Much. Mr. Marquis, do you want to come up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, representing the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association today. Thank you for the opportunity to say a few words. I know that Paul Cosgrove, on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, has been more involved in some of these discussions than we have. He is home ill today, so here I am. So I will do my best. But, you know, as far as Representative Hack's question, it is my understanding from my client that there are some mortgages that have provisions that would strictly disallow a super lien to come ahead of their lien if one is placed that could potentially put them into a default situation. As far as California is concerned around Freddie and Fannie, it's my understanding what I've been told from my client, and I will go back and do more research as I just saw the amendment yesterday for the first time and our attorneys are still looking at it. But it's been relayed to me at least that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac actually testified to the fact in California that those types of provisions still didn't fit within their guidelines as far as being able to be within a loan that is owned by those individuals. Anytime a loan comes ahead of a first mortgage, it is very troubling to a lien holder like a mortgage company. So to that effect, we are opposed to these amendments. We do think the current program is a good program. The law that we have in place today that we sat down with then chair of the committee, Representative Jules Bailey, and negotiated out, we thought was a fair compromise. It does have a provision that says that you have to seek permission from the mortgage company before a lien like this could go into place. That provision is obviously taken out in the current bill as well as in the amendment. So with that, though, I'd happy to answer any questions.
Yep. Representative Polby.
Thank you. Looking at this, in the description of this, it looks like it's treated similar to property taxes and is actually assessed in a similar way. Couldn't a mortgage lender do a requirement like they do for
tax reserves for this sort of to ensure that that payment is being made to basically completely minimize your risk of being subordinate to this?
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, that's an interesting thought. I'll have to, you know, I'll get back to you. I don't know an answer 100% on that. The difference here, though, I think, is that with an escrow account on your property taxes, that's set up at the time of the mortgage is taken out. These PACE loans come into effect after a home is already purchased. So I don't know if we have the ability to set up or to require an escrow account after the fact, but I'm happy to do some research and get back to you.
But I'm thinking you might be able to do that at the outset of a loan and just put that requirement in your contract initially. Require a reserve account similar to for taxes and insurance to cover this to ensure its payment to protect your superior lien.
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, in my case, we represent, for the most part, mostly non-depository banks, so probably a greater portion of our loans are sold to Fannie and Freddie and those types of entities. I would have to do some research to see, even in that scenario, if you could set it up to see if that was allowed or would help with those Fannie and Freddie types of guidelines, but I just need to do some research and get back to you.
Representative Barreto, I can see it in your eyes.
Yeah. Well, that. thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Holdy does bring up a good point, but even if, like the banks, when they monitor or sometimes incorporate the property taxes into the loan themselves and pay them, this here would be a loan after the mortgage, and so if they were keeping up with their mortgage and then they weren't paying the loan on the improvements under this, what recourse does the government have to come back on the homeowner?
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, I believe, I mean, if the homeowner goes into default on a PACE loan, they would have the same recourse that any other lien holder would have to, you know, go through any means to try to collect that, whether it's a foreclosure on the property or other means.
Follow up then. So then if they have a lien on the property for that and they can then foreclose on the house to get back their debt owed.
Madam Chair, Representative Barreto, that is my understanding, correct, and they would be paid first regardless of the balance of the sale of the house or anything.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to clarify on that. So if they have a PACE loan and it's in first position, the lender who gave the mortgage who thought they were in first position is no longer first, they become second. And if they default on the PACE loan, then they foreclose, then the first position mortgage holder then technically becomes in second. The property is sold in foreclosure, and it could be sold for whatever is determined by the PACE loan. It could be for whatever's owed on the PACE loan, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hack, it would go through a foreclosure process there. You know, the final sale price wouldn't necessarily, I don't believe, be determined by PACE per se, but the house could certainly sell for a lesser amount than market value.
That was my question.
And so you would have a higher scenario where in that instance that you gave, where the mortgage holder may not be made whole depending on what the overall loan to value was on the property. I believe in the amendments, I think it said you couldn't go above 97%, but in an instance where the house may be sold at 90%, there would be a loss to that mortgage holder.
Thanks. Just for clarity, in reading it, I'm a little confused. It looks like this is an assessment, set up as an assessment and not a loan. Is there a
I mean, when you look at the...
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, I don't have the amendment in front of me. I wasn't planning to testify today, so my apologies. But it's always been described to me as a loan scenario. So, I can get some information back to you if you think it would be treated differently based on an assessment versus a loan. But it's always been, from my client, it's always been talked about as it would fall under those same loan kind of categories.
Right. Thank you very much. We are going to close the work session on House Bill 3241, and it will be carried over to Thursday, May 11th. All right. We have that yet? Okay. All right. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2342.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2342 updates Oregon Insurance Code provisions applicable to health insurance in accordance with federal requirements. You have a -2 amendment. The -2 amendment replaces the underlying measure and permits the Department of Consumer and Business Services, in consultation with Health Insurance Exchange Advisory Committee, to adopt one-time temporary rules that are not in compliance with state law governing health insurance if necessitated by, if there is a change in federal law after September 1st, 2017, that is expected to cause approved premium rates to no longer meet requirements for premium rates for health benefit plan for small employers or for individual health plan, or expected to impact average out-of-pocket costs by average by insured individuals, if federal government discontinues or reduces federal payments for cost sharing reductions, if DCBS adopts rules not in compliance with state law, DCBS must immediately report with full explanation of action to Senate President, Speaker of the House, and interim committees related to health. DCBS must submit quarterly reports to committees related to health on impact of action on insurance market and the consumer. Repeals authority on January 1st, 2019, declares emergency effective upon passage. You have a no fiscal impact and no revenue impact on the -2 amendment.
Mr. Allen.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This bill comes from work that actually started almost a year ago now, that our agency was doing with the governor's office, trying to deal with stability in the individual insurance market and concerns about affordability of policies, the ability of carriers to be in geography and those sorts of things. As we were doing that work, the November elections changed kind of the theme of what we were working with, and significant changes in federal law became really kind of the number one issue that would potentially have an impact on our insurance markets. And from a calendar standpoint, there's sort of a window of rate filings are due from May 15th, and between then and about the middle of August, if there are changes in federal law, and in this context I'm using federal law pretty broadly, statutory changes, administrative rule changes, court decisions, if there's a change in that window, we've got lots of latitude within current statutes to deal with those changes and have them be reflected in product offerings and rates offered by carriers in the individual market. After that middle of August window closes, all of a sudden we go from lots of latitude and lots of tools to use to virtually nothing. And so what this bill now attempts to do for a limited period of time is give us flexibility if there is a subsequent change in federal law, again, broadly construed, to be able to make changes in the requirements of the Oregon Insurance Code around the individual market that can deal with things like plan design, rates, cost sharing requirements. We tried to think about how to do this this work in a sort of a very specific, let's think about this problem and how would you fix it, and then that problem and how would you fix it. And it really got to be kind of an exercise in coming up with an unlimited list of potential changes that we really couldn't forecast very well. And so what you see is pretty broad language. It gives us wide latitude during the 2 years that this would be in effect, with a requirement that we deal with that we go through the advisory committee that was created under Senate Bill 1 when we took over the health insurance marketplace functions, and come back quarterly and report to you on what we have done and why, and what the effects are, and what's going on as a result of the changes that we would make. We would then fully expect that if we've got actual opportunities to legislate, to bring you legislation during that window, that we would do that as well if we're able to identify how to plug our system back into whatever the federal changes are. We would expect to do that. What you have then is that bill that we were able to work with the leadership of the House and Senate Health Care Committees and the Speaker's Office to try to get to a place where we thought we could come up with enough sideboards to make that that flexibility work well. We've engaged with stakeholders. We think this is broadly supported legislation, and be happy to answer questions you might have.
Yes, Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I have a question about this. Have you worked with council on this? Because I'm having a difficult time understanding how we can authorize an agency to violate our statutory rules.
Legislative Council drafted this amendment, and we worked closely with them on how to construct it in a way that they felt was within the parameters of statute. I'm not a lawyer.
I take their word for it. We don't need one.
Could Representative Hack?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In light of the same question, could we have somebody from LC maybe come in and maybe address that concern?
Try.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so wouldn't it seem prudent just to bring the legislature back in for a special session to deal with this if it was, if it's that big of an issue? I mean, health care is a big thing, you know, so if we're talking about adjusting rates or compensation and there can be a huge fiscal cost to that, wouldn't it be prudent then and not be setting precedents here, I think, by giving an agency or commission the authority to make those big decisions?
Chair Williamson, Representative Bredo, I guess the range of possible impacts federal changes could have seems to me would run kind of a gamut from things that really are almost regulatory in nature but not quite to really significant changes, and being dependent on a special session and all of the complexities that go with that to try to make those adjustments seems challenging in terms of trying to offer, particularly to consumers and to carriers, some degree of stability and certainty that the system will be held together and work during this couple of year period where we really don't know what the federal government is going to do. I couldn't go to a carrier and say, you should really be in this market because if something goes wrong, we'll ask for a special session and it'll get fixed. That's a tough sell.
Representative Rayfield.
So, I just would kind of like, just want to add back on the special session issue because I think this is important. Special sessions are not free. When you come in here, you have a small group of folks that are really working who have the depth of knowledge to be able to address the issues, and then we work to the entire body to move through something in a very unnimble way. So it's kind of looking at this, I don't know if that's necessarily the best way to address and be flexible in the moment. Very cumbersome.
Can I add to that? Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and I think the scope of this is very broad, you know, to where it's not really drilled down onto how complex or how big this issue is for them to go in and change state law.
And someone from LC is on her way, so.
Good afternoon, Chair Williamson and committee members. My name is Rachel Wiggins-Emery, here on behalf of Cambia Health Solutions, testifying in support of the Dash 2 amendments. As we know, with significant changes to the ACA being discussed, there is the potential that these changes could affect the soundness of the filed rates, and because of this, DCBS needs the flexibility of the rate approval process. Because of that, Cambia is in support. Thank you.
Chair Williamson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the policy director with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a statewide consumer advocacy group. And although I am not here speaking on behalf of the committee, I'll also just mention that I'm the vice chair of the Marketplace Advisory Committee, which is mentioned in the bill. And Osperg supports this bill with the Dash 2 amendments. We think this provides some necessary tools for Oregon insurance regulators and the health insurance marketplace to respond quickly to protect consumers and preserve a competitive market for health insurance in this state in the event of potentially disruptive federal legislative or administrative action. We hope that the powers outlined in this bill never have to be used, at least for my part, but this bill is a prudent step to make sure that we have the tools that we need. Oregon's health insurance markets and the consumers who rely on them are really facing unprecedented uncertainty. Right now, I've never seen anything like it. And Osperg and our members across the state are deeply concerned about the one piece of this that's making the headlines, which is the American Health Care Act, currently being debated in Congress and just passed the House last week. This legislation would not only lead to the loss of health coverage for hundreds of thousands of Oregonians, as was outlined in a report put out by the governor's office and DCBS and OHA, it also risks sparking chaos in health insurance markets that could drive up costs and degrade quality of care, even for those who are able to maintain coverage. And the American Health Care Act is not the only thing that we need to be worried about in this context. There's unresolved threats to the Affordable Care Act's cost-sharing reduction program and a whole slew of other changes that could come down the pike that could risk further disruption and even higher costs. And this legislation is not enough to protect consumers against all of those risks, but it will help address the possibility that we could get locked into this situation where rates and plans were approved for next year based on the status quo, and that those were just no longer sustainable or viable. And this gives regulators the tools to address that situation. And this legislation does convey extraordinary powers to DCBS, but they are time limited, and it also does establish a robust and transparent public process by requiring direction from the Marketplace Advisory Committee. And as vice chair of that committee, I commit to working to make sure that there's a robust public process that informs any use of these powers that may prove to be necessary. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? All right, thank you. Oh, sorry. You got to raise your hand higher, Representative Holby. I can't see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I understand it, I guess the purpose for this is that if a federal law were to change and basically make the current premium rates or some reimbursement that's falls outside of what our current statutes and rules power would be given to DCBS to adopt new rules, and then also after doing that, report immediately to the legislature on why that happened and what rules were changed.
Yeah, let me give you a concrete example, if I could. Cost sharing reductions have been in the news. This is an amount of money that's contributed into plans above and beyond premium tax credits that helps buy down the cost of deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums and those kinds of things for people who are at the very lowest end of the income levels that qualify for the Affordable Care Act plans. And there's been a lot of talk about whether they'll continue to make those plans. There's a court case pending right now that's basically suspended. The administration has periodically made noises that they may not choose to pay those going forward, but right now they are paying them, and everyone agrees that they're being paid. So our expectation would be that rates will be filed on the assumption that those are being paid, because that's what current law is. Let's say in October the administration decides that for 2018 they're not going to make those payments anymore. We would have no ability to make any adjustment, and that's a fairly significant dollar amount in terms of impact on Oregon. Under current law, we would have no ability to make any kind of adjustment to rates for Oregon carriers for 2018 to reflect that, short of asking for a special session to authorize that. And so that's the kind of a thing where we would be able with this to make a finding, work through the advisory committee, make adjustments in one fashion or another in terms of not necessarily rates, perhaps product offerings or features of plans or something like that to accommodate that change. And this would give us the ability to be able to do that and then report back to you that we had done that, and on an ongoing basis report on the impacts.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the quick response.
Members of the committee, Chair Williamson, my name is Lori Freeman. I'm with the Office of Legislative Counsel. I was the drafter on this bill.
Elsie, yeah, go ahead, Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Thank you for coming down. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'm wondering about the precedent and the reasonableness of telling an agency that they can knowingly violate current statutory language and how legal that is. And frankly, Representative Barreto said it seemed to him that maybe this was an appropriate time to have a special session if it were done. And I can't imagine this, although there is potentially an ominous situation in the future, I can't imagine it's without precedent. And so I'm wondering, how have we handled this in the past? And is this an appropriate way to handle it, an appropriate and legal way to handle it?
Representative Williamson, Representative Kenemer, I'm not aware of any precedents. Now, we did, in 2015, I think, we allowed, there were some changes in the ACA that were going to affect plans that were not grandfathered plans, and there was a worry about how it would affect premium costs and so forth, and so we did stick a little provision in that authorized DCBS to go ahead and preserve what we called transitional plans at the time based on federal guidance rather than federal law. But you're absolutely right. This goes well beyond that. Mm-hmm. I think, however, that because it has criteria prescribed that are fairly narrow, that's really what the test would be for any court, is whether or not is the delegation just a carte blanche, or is the delegation, does it have specific criteria to guide the agency in the event that someone wanted to challenge the agency's decision, there would be criteria that a court could apply. So I really can't say one way or the other how a court would come down on that. But I think it's probably okay because it is fairly narrowly tailored.
Bretto.
Yeah, I think you said the criteria is fairly narrow, but when you look at discontinuing or reducing federal payments for cost-sharing reductions, could be into huge volume of dollars, couldn't it?
Representative Williamson, Representative Barreto, that is correct.
If there's a reduction of cost sharing without this bill, who carries the burden of making up those additional payments?
Representative Williamson, the premiums have already been approved. So basically, if the cost sharing, the cost sharing helps the consumers. And so if the cost sharing were taken away, it would make everything pretty much unaffordable for the consumers that qualify for the cost sharing.
Yes, Representative Kenemer.
Well, I guess that gets back to my question again. It seems to me like this, given the magnitude of this, that it probably is more appropriate to have a special session, try and ferret out what in the world we're going to do, rather than have an agency without direct legislative supervision formulating Plan B. I guess that was more a statement than a question, excuse me, but I was trying to figure out where I was going here.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Chair. I think, and maybe this is an agency question or maybe a comment to the agency, with the magnitude of this, I'm actually kind of surprised that the agency would want to take that on and not look to the legislative body for some guidance, especially given the fact that now we have I mean, Legislative Council is even saying it could be challenged. There's a possibility that it could be challenged whether or not it goes against statutory law, and that seems to be a huge burden to place on our agency out there functioning on its own and not having the support of a legislative body to come around them. Do you have, I mean, does LC have concerns about doing that to an agency? Does the agency have concern about taking on something like that? And the possible repercussion of, I mean, that's a huge, massive undertaking.
Certainly we have concerns, and this is not the sort of thing that we would look at wanting the authority for, nor exercising the authority if we were to get it lightly. But we are on the hook for keeping the individual market stable. Last summer we went through a near-death experience with a number of counties in Oregon, whether they were going to have carriers at all. And we've been doing absolutely everything we can possibly do since then to make sure we don't find ourselves in that kind of a circumstance again, so that all Oregonians have got access to competitive options for insurance, both on and off the marketplace. And we've been encouraged to believe by carriers, as well as by other stakeholders, that anything that we can do that offers a sense of countervailing stability in a time of high instability at the federal level helps make it easier for them to be in the market in the short term. And so, yeah, there are certainly risks and concerns about this, but I'm committed to doing whatever I can to fulfill my mission, which is to make sure Oregonians have got access to health insurance.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. I'm glad you came back up. How fast would, I mean, if the federal government were to discontinue the cost sharing, how fast would those reductions impact a consumer potentially?
Chair Williamson, Representative Holby, that's a great question. And I'm not sure. I think there is actually an open question to the earlier issue of what would be the impact if rates and product designs are filed. I think there is an argument that I would think is stronger, that it's the carrier that's on the hook to make good on plan design that had zero deductibles or low copays or those sorts of features, so it could have a profound impact on the financial stability of carriers. It's one of the reasons that's such a concern to carriers right now. In answer to how quickly, the director of the Office of Management and Budget, I think last week, actually said something to the effect of, we make those payments on the 20th of the month, check with me on the 19th whether we're going to make the May payment. So, you know, I think that there could be decisions of that scale that could happen fairly quickly. Now, again, that's an example that I used earlier. There are other things that are quite a bit more mundane. There's lots of discussion about changing the required actuarial values of plans. Right now, a bronze plan pays 60% of your expenses, silver 70, and so on. There are changes that are meaningful that could fiddle with those actuarial levels that would necessitate us perhaps making some plan design changes or allowances for how those kinds of things work, that I would suggest don't rise to the level of the kind of an impact and significance of what we were just talking about with cost-sharing reductions. That's part of the challenge with this, is it's such a wide range of kinds of impacts that we're trying to anticipate and be able to deal with nimbly while keeping carriers in our market.
Representative Knowles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, could you reveal to the committee how many lives are potentially impacted by this?
That's about 250,000 lives in the individual market.
That presumes only an impact on the individual folks in the market,
true,
as opposed to plans generally, public or private, as well, right? I mean, if you're talking about stabilities of carriers.
Well, so, yeah, there are various segments of the market that are at various kinds of risk. Mostly we're usually talking about the individual market, but you're right, the small group market is also regulated by us, as well as the large group market. Large private plans, self-insured businesses were actually regulatory preempted.
Right.
That's about 750,000 lives in that market.
Representative Representative Nose.
So if we don't do this and we have to come in a special session to deal with this, how long are we hanging out here trying to craft a solution, figuring this out? It's sort of, maybe it's a rhetorical question. I'm wondering, you know, why meanwhile we have all these covered lives wondering what's going to go on with their health care, and we have, what, 8 carriers in this state deciding whether or not they can afford to actually provide coverage. And be, I mean, it seems like, you know, there's a no-win. It's not a, it's a sort of a no-win situation. And I guess from my vantage point, just what I understand about insurance, this feels like the safest thing to try. We could still, if it all goes completely, I would still come into special session if we absolutely needed to. This gives an agency some understanding of the insurance market and how it really works relative to the rest of us who don't do this for a living, some ability to prop up something that's super important for 250,000 people and maybe more, because other people are impacted by it to the point that you just made.
Senator Kenemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Allen, is there precedent for this kind of authorization for an agency?
Chair Williamson, Representative Kenemer, I'm not aware whether there is or isn't. All I'm aware of is we're in fairly unprecedented water generally on health care at the moment.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair. Do we know if there are any other states that are looking at doing this same thing? Or are we kind of running out first, solo, what?
Chair Williamson, Representative Hack, this is fairly unique, but we also have actually a fairly unique dynamic with health insurance in Oregon. We have a market that, despite some of the tremors that it's had over the last couple of years, continues to be quite competitive. It's dominated by local or quasi-local, largely nonprofit organizations who really are committed to being in the market and are really dependent on and with whom we're working hard to try to provide enough stability for them to do what they want to do, which is stay in the market. I think that's very different from markets elsewhere in the country that tend to be dominated by large national players who've got a lot of other kinds of calculus that goes into that.
Right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2342. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2342.
Chair,
yes.
We'll need to recess for just a minute.
Recess. I'm going to just close the work session on House Bill 2342 for now. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2332.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2332 was originally heard at the end of April. The measure extends supervision of requirement that state agencies attain 11-to-1 ratio of non-supervisory employees to supervisory employees to the 2017-19 biennium. You did have, and we discussed at the last hearing, the -2 amendment. You do have a -3 amendment today. It does everything the -2 does, which is replaces the underlying measure, requires state agency with more than 100 employees to develop as part of their adopted budget, report for joint ways and means on state agency's proposed maximum supervisory ratio. Agencies must determine their maximum supervisory ratio starting at 11-to-1 and adjusting based on a number of factors specified in the amendment. Joint ways and means will review the ratio reported by each agency and include information in a budget report or note. Agency whose supervisory ratio is greater than the approved maximum may not fill the supervisory position unless DAS determines it's necessary. DAS will provide quarterly reports on actual supervisory ratio of each agency, provides rulemaking authority to DAS, defines a number of terms including job families, legislative adopted budget, supervisory employees, supervisory ratio, state agencies. The difference between the -2 and the -3 is it strikes and makes it very clear that Secretary of State's office and Oregon State Treasurer are not a state agency for purposes of this measure. It comes to you with minimal fiscal and no revenue impact on the -3.
Please, Ms. Baker.
Thank you.
members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lindsay Baker with the Department of Administrative Services. That was a very thorough summary of what the bill and specifically Dash 3 amendments do, so I will not go over them in detail. By way of background, I was here before you a couple of weeks ago now, and I brought forward the Dash 2 amendments, which outline exactly how Aaron just described them. At that time, Representative McLean indicated that he wanted to have a little bit more time to review the measure and the amendments, chat with a few folks and figure out what they do and whether that was something that he was comfortable moving forward with. Since that time, I have met with hopefully all of the members of this committee and have assuaged some concerns if there were any. So to that end, I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any. Other than that, I don't have anything else prepared.
We have a Dash 3 amendment, is that correct?
Right.
Yeah.
All right. And just one more note is that as Aaron indicated, the Dash 2 amendments, which were discussed and I brought forward last time, the Dash 3 amendments are exactly the same as that. The only change that they make is making it very clear that the Office of the State Treasurer and the Office of the Secretary of State are not included. There was, I think both those offices asked for a little bit more clarity in that, in the amendment.
All right. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2332.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2332. Is there any discussion? Representative Holvey.
Just to bring this up, I noticed that there was a definition of supervisory employee. So I was wondering what agencies that applies to, because there's a lot of definitions of supervisory employees, you know, for fire, police, faculty. And so in this particular version, who does it apply to?
So Chair Williamson, Representative Holvey, in this version of the amendment, the 11-to-1 ratio in this new process that we're imposing applies to all agencies that have 100 or more FTE. So that really does narrow it a little bit. And specifically to your question, I believe that the definition attempted to capture some of the nuance. However, I think that any more specific statutory, like within chapters of any agency, if there's a more specific one, I expect that would govern.
I guess I was trying to get at that these definitions of supervisory employees mm-hmm. are for state agencies and not local governments or universities.
Correct. Correct. That's correct. Chair Williamson, Representative Holvey, my understanding is that the definition of supervisory employees applies only to those that are subject to the new management supervisory ratio. Correct. Yes.
Other discussion? Are there any objections? Motion carries. We just amended that. Mm-hmm. I need another motion.
All right, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2332 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved House Bill 2332 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion passes. Representative Holvey, want to carry that? You asked the question. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2332. I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2545.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2545A authorizes Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to grant license to deception detection examination administered in manner similar to polygraph examiners, punishes violation of measure or rules adopted pursuant to measure as Class A misdemeanor, punishes practicing without a license as Class B misdemeanor, specifies requirements for issuance of license, prohibits administration of deception detection exam or use of title without license, clarifies use as unlawful employment practice. You have a Dash A9 amendment, Madam Chair. It replaces the measure, removes requirement for DPSST to regulate deception detection examination administers, adds ocular motor deception detection examination to definition of deception detection examination, allows police, corrections, parole, and probation officers to use as instrument or mechanical device to detect deception or verify the truth of statements except traditional polygraph machine in course of investigating crime, conducting an investigation into misconduct in prison, or providing oversight over parolees and probationers. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do not have the fiscal statement on the dash A9. We do have a no revenue statement, though.
All right, Director Gablix.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Eric Gablix. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known as DPSST. I'd like to thank the members for allowing us to work on the Dash 9 with staff. A lot of you know the DPSST is traditionally known as the Police Academy, the Fire Academy, all these different things that we do. Through legislative action, we train and certify 41,000 public safety constituents in the state of Oregon, of which less than 100 are polygraph examiners, which are required by statute to be licensed by DPSST. What you have in front of you is really technology evolving to the place where things that were never imagined are in front of you today. So really what this bill creates is the ability for law enforcement officers to use tools that were not imagined more than 30 years ago when polygraph was created. The polygraph statute stays whole and in place as it currently is, but what this does is allows deception equipment. In this case, the technology we're talking about is eyeball movement, where a person can sit in front of a screen, be asked questions, and through an algorithm, that test, if you will, is sent to a cloud, and that algorithm says whether or not that person is being truthful. So what we have done with staff is created the ability, based on testimony that was given to judiciary, to allow certified police officers, corrections officers, and parole and probation officers to use this new equipment and any new technology coming forward, other than polygraph, because polygraph lane is very clear. If you're going to use polygraph, those people have to be licensed by DPSST, but this allows these tools to be used. So the polygraph statute stands whole, no interruption there. The people must be certified, so that way if they do misuse this equipment, we can hold them accountable for the misconduct, as Aaron framed it nicely. And under the Dash 9, there is no fiscal impact to DPSST.
Well, Director Gablix, the difference between the polygraph is you have to be trained to administer a polygraph. You don't necessarily have to have the same level of training or supervision to use some of the new technology.
Correct. Chair Williamson, members of the committee, that is spot on. Under the polygraph equipment, you're going to months of training to learn how to read and analyze the polygraph test to use the equipment. What we're seeing now is with the technology, the computer in the cloud already has the algorithm established, so the person administering the test, and I don't want to diminish it, they're lining up the person to answer the questions. The algorithm has been created that basically gives the guidance whether or not the person's being truthful or not.
I want to thank Representative Hack for all her hard work on this with the director. So thank you both for the work you put in on this bill.
Well, and Chair, thank you. And Aaron, thank you for your work that you did, too. And thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash A9 amendment to House Bill 2545A.
Vice Chair Rayfield has moved the Dash A9 amendment into House Bill 2545A. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Motion carries.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is as far as we can go with the measure right now.
It just popped up for a request, so I don't think you get it yet.
All right, so with that, I will close the work session. We're rolling over 2545 to Thursday as well, and we're rolling over House Bill 2342 to Thursday.
And then, Madam Chair, members of the committee, just to confirm, we did already carry over 3241 to Thursday. 3361 will be carried over until next Tuesday, the 16th, and we move 2332.
Great. No, we were waiting.